Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Proponents of the unification in Europe have long argued that closer ties across national borders would help preserve the peace and also lead to prosperity. And certainly one part of that equation has been achieved. There may be some questions about the other. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about Europe, its economic and political issues. And we have two guests to have that conversation with. Joining me here in the studio is Kostas Kotikakis. He's a professor of political science here at University of Illinois, has been with us before here on the program to talk about some of the economic problems of the EU, particularly centering on Greece. And also, we're expecting here in just a moment to be speaking with the ambassador of the EU, the European Union, to the United States. His name is João Valle del Almeida, and he is going to be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois a little bit later in the week. In fact, he will be the keynote speaker for the 11th annual European Union Day. He'll be giving the State of the European Union address, and this is taking place on Thursday, March 29th, 10 o'clock in the morning at the U of I Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. This is part of a day-long series of events put together here by the European Union Center here at the University of Illinois. And if you would be interested in finding out more about what's going on or about the center, you can go to their website, which is euc.illinois.edu. And I'm sure that you can find out a lot more information about the event and also about the issues that have to do with the EU. So as we talk in this part of Focus, we certainly would invite people to call in. Maybe you have some questions to pose or you'd like to write in. You can send us your question that way. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Or you can send us an email if you'd like to do that. And that is, the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Either way, you're certainly welcome to participate in the conversation. Just a little bit more about our guest, the ambassador, Mr. Valle de Almeida, is head of the delegation of the European Union to the United States. Before his appointment to Washington, he served as Director General for External Relations at the European Commission. That's the European Union's executive body. Also, between 2004 and 2009, he served as the Chief of Staff and main advisor for the European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Ambassador, hello.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm great. Nice weather in Washington. I hope you have nice weather over there as well.
A little chilly, but appropriate for this time of year, I think. We'll try and warm it up a little bit for you by the time that you get here. I am interested. You know, you will be, I mentioned you will be here a little later in the week. I understand also that next week, I believe that you're going to be in Iowa City. What's the interest of the European Union in the Midwest?
Well, I'll be in Iowa City already this week before getting... Before getting to Illinois. And, you know, I've set myself the objective of visiting the 50 states of the United States because I believe an ambassador to this country has to know the country. And the country is much more than Washington or Washington's Beltway. We need to go beyond the Beltway, and that's the purpose of my regular visits to deep America.
Mm. Let me ask you about some comments that you made recently. This was at an event that was took place in Brussels, and it was apparently organized by the American Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
And you said that you believed that the United States overestimated the role of China in the world and underestimated that of the EU and Europe. You said the economic crisis has not helped portray a vibrant, dynamic image of Europe. If anything, the opposite image has been conveyed. So in what way do you think that Americans underestimate the importance of Europe?
Well, in the sense that, you know, it's only normal that we are focused on China and Asia. We do the same in Europe. So this is not a criticism of America. I think it's, you know, realizing the fact that we are so impressed by the vitality of the Asian economy and the Chinese economy that we sometimes forget that we have, across the Atlantic, the most important economic relationship in the world. Together we represent 50% of world's GDP, one-third of world's trade. We are each other's best customers and best investors by far, and this is a reality for the entire United States, if you relate it to Europe, as it is for individual states. And that's the reality I was calling an attention to.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about what you think Americans should know about the economic problems that we now have been reading about for some time in Europe.
Well, you know, I used to call it the aftershocks of the financial crisis of 2008. This was a very serious crisis. It started in the United States, but it spread to Europe very, very quickly and to the entire economy. And we went through a difficult period in 2008, 2009. What we're watching now and realizing in Europe is a number of aftershocks of this crisis, which had an impact particularly on our most vulnerable countries. And the case of Greece has been talked about, of course, in the last few months. So what we're doing in Europe is basically addressing the impact of these aftershocks, helping vulnerable countries deal with them, as we're doing in the case of Greece or Portugal or Ireland, and most importantly, looking at our system and see how much it needs reform in order to be able to deal with this kind of situation. So what is going on in Europe, and that's why you hear a lot about discussions and decisions and long meetings in Europe, is that because we are 27 countries, independent countries, we need to agree on a consensual basis what needs to be done. Mm. But basically what Europe is doing is a small revolution in the way we organize ourselves in order to deal with the impact of this crisis. And we hope that when it ends, when the process is over, will be stronger and fitter in terms of our competitiveness in the world economy. Mm.
Well, specifically about Greece, the EU has agreed to help Greece avert economic collapse, has asked for austerity measures in exchange, and I think that perhaps that there still remains an open question about whether, in fact, this is going to work and whether it would prevent a rather devastating collapse of the Greek economy. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, that we had no alternative. We had to do this. We were under enormous pressure from the markets. The situation was almost unbearable in terms of the Greek economy, the Greek public finances. But you cannot isolate a country if you have a single market like we have among the 27. If you share a common currency like we have among the 17 countries that have the euro as their currency. So we need to address also the systemic issues, you know, the impact of one country into the system. And this is what we've been doing. But now I'm very glad to see that in the last few months, you know, basically since December, January, February, now March, I mean, all the news are on the positive side. We were able to find a solution for the Greek situation, and the markets have reacted well. We see the beginning of us coming out of the woods, and we hope by the last quarter of this year, Europe and the euro area will be back to the path of growth. And in the last meetings, in the last summits of the European Union, I was very impressed to see that people, leaders, are now talking about growth, measures to increase and guarantee that we have a sustainable growth. So I'm more optimistic today than I was 3 months ago.
Well, having said that and maintain that kind of optimism, I think I have to ask about other countries, because there is concern that similar bailouts would have to be engineered for Spain, for example, or Portugal. There may be some other places that one's concerned about. Do you in fact think that that's going to happen?
Well, Portugal, we already have an assistance program to Portugal. Things are, you know, the program is being implemented well by the Portuguese government, so we are optimistic on the outcome. Spain is not being assisted. There is no special program for Spain. But the Spanish government has been called upon to implement a very serious program of reform, austerity, but also structural reform. And let me mention one point, which I think is very important. We talk a lot about austerity in Europe, but at the same time, what we're doing in all our countries is to introduce reforms in the way the economy operates. For instance, we are looking at the labor market laws, you know, the way the labor market is operate, in order to make it more flexible, in order to allow companies to be able to recruit when they need and where they need, and for the increased mobility of the labor force. We are looking at the pension system. You know, our societies are getting old, and there is a serious issue of sustainability of public finances in terms of pension system. So we are dealing with that as well. So it's not only austerity for austerity, it is austerity to deal with very urgent and serious situations now, but implementing at the same time the reforms that will make our economies more competitive in the near future.
Our guest in this hour is João Vale de Almeida. He is the head of the delegation of the European Union to the United States. He'll be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois a little bit later in the week for the 11th annual European Union Day. He'll be giving the keynote talk, and he'll be here on Thursday, March 29th. He'll talk in the morning at the Ellis Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. And again, if you're interested in finding out some more about this event, you might go to the website of the European Union Center, euc.illinois.edu, here at the University of Illinois. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I'd like to have you talk a little bit in more basic terms about the project of the EU. And I think that the idea here was it was very much motivated by the destruction of the two world wars. People, I think, were very concerned about peace and wanting to make sure that nothing like that ever happened again. But there also was the idea that by harmonizing economic systems, that it would be good for the economies of all of the countries,
yes.
Freer movement of people and goods and so forth. And, of course, then there was the adoption of the common currency, the euro.
Yes.
And now at the same time, I think that some people have asked all along, you know, we're doing something here where we're taking some very large countries with very large economies like Germany and France and putting them in this organization with smaller countries with much smaller economies like Spain and Portugal and Greece and
yes.
and so forth, and have wondered whether, in fact, you really can do that. I think that there was some concern about whether the big countries would dominate, and now there seems to be some concerns about whether the big countries are going to have to bail out the small ones. Does that call into question the very idea of the EU?
I don't think so. On the contrary, the very idea of the EU, as you rightly said, is about peace. You know, Europeans have been fighting inside the European continent for too long. The last expression of that, almost permanent civil war in Europe were, of course, the two world wars of the 20th century that started in Europe. We don't want any more of that. And for the last 50 to 60 years, we have had, in fact, the longest period of peace in the European continent ever. And this is an incredible achievement, and we want to stay on that course. So this is the main reason. Reconcile Europeans with Europeans is our project. In order to do that, you have to create links. You have to create interdependence, interconnection among people. Well, it's basically what you did here in the United States, where you have states of different size and different economic weight. I don't need to give you examples. The states in the United States are not all equal in size and economic dimension, and you still live together in harmony. So I think it's perfectly possible. In our case, we started much later than you. We are much younger as a political and economic entity. But I think the achievements so far are quite impressive. If you think that we started with six countries, basically around France and Germany, in the late 50s of the last century. We are now 27, soon to be 28, with the addition of Croatia next year, and we are half a billion population in Europe, with a continental dimension from the Atlantic shores of my hometown, Lisbon, to the Russian border. And this is an incredible achievement if you consider that these countries live in democracy, they respect human rights, the rule of law, individual freedom, high quality of life standards, environmental protection, consumer protection, and a very dynamic economic activity. Going through problems now, as I said, as a result of the aftershocks of the financial crisis, but working very actively and in a determined way to overcome this. So this is where we are. Mm. If we have discussion inside, we do, because we are a democratic system. If sometimes countries disagree, they do sometimes disagree. But at the end of the day, we manage to find the necessary consensus.
What possibility do you see of further expansion? Are there particular countries that you would think would be likely candidates for inclusion?
I mean, we've identified a number of countries that have the vocation, the potential to become European Union member states. And that is particularly the case for countries in the Balkans, which is a region which has had enough of problems to now be very focused and very determined to create the conditions to join the Union. Slovenia is a member now for a few years. Croatia, as I said, will join in principle next year. And a number of other countries, take Serbia, take Montenegro, are very busy getting prepared to reach the level that would allow them to join the Union. It's a very demanding exercise because they need to meet political criteria, they have to be fully established democracies, but they also have to meet economic criteria. They have to be at the level of compliance with EU rules in order to allow them to integrate smoothly into our Union. So I see the prospect of a few more countries coming in, and I think we are very encouraged by the fact that a number of countries want to join the Union because they see this as a guarantee for their political and economic sustainability. And I think it shows that the project is very much alive.
Mm. A couple of years ago, there was the announcement of the possibility that Turkey would join the EU. And I think that was initially greeted with a fair amount of excitement on both sides, at least that is in Turkey and in Europe. And it seemed, though, very quickly hit a wall of people who were concerned about cultural issues. At least some Europeans were concerned about cultural issues because they said, well, Turkey is not a European country. And they perhaps, to be charitable, said that they thought it was not a natural fit. Then it seemed that at that point, things cool a little bit on the Turkish side. Where does that stand now, and do you think that it is possible that one day Turkey could be a member of the EU?
Yes, I do, and we are, in fact, working for that to be achieved. Not tomorrow, not next year. It will take a few years for us to be in a position to make the final decision whether or not Turkey is able to join. So it's very much in the cards, and the negotiations are pursuing. Now, you're right in saying that there have been some problems, and I have to admit that it's not an easy file. Why? First of all, because of the size of Turkey. Turkey will become a very important member of the European Union in relative terms because of its population, because of the size of its territory. Secondly, because of the geographic location of Turkey. Turkey is on the periphery, the eastern periphery of Europe. It's considered a European country, so eligible for accession. But they are placed in an extremely sensitive area of our neighborhood, so which, of course, brings all sorts of issues into play. They also have a particular difficult relationship with one of our present member states, Cyprus, because Turkish forces occupy part of the island, so there's a long-standing dispute and conflict that, of course, complicates things in terms of the relations between us and them. And thirdly, you have the fact that Turkey is, to a very large extent, a Muslim country. This is not a problem for Europe in the sense that we don't make a distinction of the predominant religions of our member states. That's not an issue. That's not a criterion for accession, and should not discriminate any country. But I must recognize that this has raised in the public debate in Europe, as much as in Turkey, a few questions that need to be addressed before we reach the point of a final decision. In the meantime, negotiations go on. In the meantime, Turkey is reforming its country in order to comply with the rules and the parameters and the standards of the European Union. And this, in such, is already a very important process for Turkey and the Turkish population.
Well, Turkey is an interesting case because it is a country that in many ways, geographically, politically, culturally, has one foot in the East and one foot in the West. But as you say, it is a majority Muslim country. That's not going to change. How do you engineer a change in European public opinion if a majority of Europeans look at Turkey and they say, well, Turkey is not Europe, so it just doesn't belong in the EU?
Well, I don't think the majority of the population in Europe thinks that way, but I recognize that there is a discussion taking place right now about this. This being said, and again on the Muslim issue, I mean, if you look at today's Europe, the 27 member states, you will see large parts of the population of some, at least, of our member states are of or follow the Muslim religion. So it's not that we are a club of a Christian club. We are not a Christian club. We have inside our member states people from different religions, including Muslim, but also many other religions. So we are not at all excluding people who have not the majority religion of Europe, because that kind of concept doesn't exist for us. So we will never discriminate Turkey on the basis of religion. What I'm saying is that I recognize that there is a political debate, a public debate, about whether or not it is in the interest of Europe and in the interest of Turkey to join the Union. But so far, the process has not been interrupted, has not been suspended, let alone put aside. It will take some years. We will continue determined to find the best way to have Turkey closer to Europe. We believe this is in the interest of Turkey and in the interest of Europe, and that's the path we're following right now.
I'm sure that the challenge here for the EU and for the administration of the EU is to take whatever issue you're talking about, whether this be economic issues or this be political issues, and get 27 governments to agree on a coherent policy.
Yes.
That's certainly very difficult, I'm sure, when you're talking about economic issues. It is also difficult, perhaps more difficult, when you're talking about political ones. And I think one particular case that people are looking at now is the EU and the manner in which it should respond to the vast, sweeping and surprising, certainly to us in the United States as well, surprising political change that we've seen in the Middle East.
Yeah.
How are the governments of the EU thinking about this, and in what way they might respond?
Well, first of all, the internal discussion and the fact that we need to bring countries together, it's part of the beauty of our project in a way, because it's better to have countries discuss what they can do together than have countries fighting, as we did in the past. So I think this is a very good kind of problem to be solved. And that's the daily life in the Union, in the European Union, is, you know, permanently seeking solutions, consensual solutions to our problems, because we believe that it's better for our individual interest as a country to do that in a collective way, because we will we'll be stronger, our voice in the world will be stronger. So that's the rationale behind the European construction. But it sometimes takes time and many hours of discussion to get disagreements. Mm-hmm. On the issue of the Middle East and the Arab Spring and Northern Africa, I think, first of all, we were all very happy to see these, what Zbigniew Brzezinski has called a global awakening, which is basically populations saying that they want to determine their own future. And I think we should all welcome this. But we should also realize that these transitions from dictatorship or authoritarian regimes to democracy They are not linear processes. They are not easy processes. It takes time. It's a bumpy road, and we have to be ready for obstacles on the way, moving forward and sometimes moving backwards before you move forward again. And I think people in Europe recognize that. And some of our countries, by the way, have recently been involved in this kind of transition. If you take Eastern Europe moving out of the Iron Curtain, if you take less recently countries like Portugal or Spain or Greece that came out of right-wing dictatorships, we have an experience of transition to democracy, and now we are ready to share with these countries our own experience. We are ready to support them in this process. And we are also ready to work with the United States and to cooperate with the United States in creating the best conditions for transition to democracy in the Middle East and the Arab region.
So just to, where I know we're about at the point where we need to let you go, but just to come back around to the point where we started, where I just mentioned your the comments that you had made recently about America underestimating the importance of Europe. Tell me what... is there some aspect of the relationship? Obviously, relations between the United States and Europe are quite positive and go back a long way. But is there some way in which you think there is some kind of room for improvement there?
Well, first of all, let me try to focus a little bit on Illinois, because we sometimes talk about two large realities for people to understand. And again, I say and I remind you that... you know, together, EU and the U.S., we represent 50% of world's GDP, the world's wealth, and 30% of world's trade. But if you look at Illinois as such, exports from Illinois to the European Union improved by 28% in 2011 as compared to 2010. We're talking about more than $11 billion in goods sold to Europe in 2011, mostly machinery, chemicals, and computers. But if you look the other way around, you see that more than 700 European companies conduct operations in Illinois, and they've created more than 180,000 jobs in your state. You know, companies like Siemens, BMW, Lufthansa, Deutsche Telekom, BP, you name it, Unilever. And this is the day-to-day reality of our economic relationship. Jobs being created across the Atlantic, here in the America and in Europe, investment flowing across the Atlantic. But as you were hinting at, I think we can do more and better. I think we can, utilize the full potential and realize the full potential of our relationship if we go a little bit further in bringing down obstacles to trade and investment. We see the potential there. So we are now preparing on both sides of the Atlantic ideas, putting together figures and options to see to what extent we can improve the flow of capital across the Atlantic, the flow of investment, better access to each other's markets, with the purpose of creating more jobs. So more jobs for Illinois, I hope, in the future, coming from Europe.
Our guest this morning, Ambassador Joao Vale de Almeida, is the head of the delegation of the European Union to the United States. And he will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois this week on Thursday to be the keynote speaker for the 11th annual European Union Day. And if people want to find out more about this, they can go to the website of the European Union Center on the U of I campus, euc.illinois.edu is the web address. And Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you for hosting me. A pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to coming to your state Thursday and Friday.
All right. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. We'll talk some more about European politics after a very short break. This is Focus.
Tonight, it's special coverage from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for a recap of today's arguments. That's special coverage from NPR News. The Supreme Court debates health care.
Tonight at 9 on AM 580.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and your comments. In the second hour today, we'll have more on the subject of affordable housing and the need for affordable housing in East Central Illinois. We discussed that a little bit yesterday with guests from the cities of Urbana and Champaign. And in the second hour today, we will talk with the directors of the housing authorities of Champaign County and also of Danville. And in addition, we'll have as our guest joining us by phone, Gloria Thompson. She's residential coordinator for the Green Meadows Housing Complex that's in Danville. Also, I'd just like to mention again that we'll be doing a television special tonight, a live show at 8 o'clock on WILL-TV, also on AM and online. And we've gathered together some people who deal with housing from various perspectives. And we'll talk some more again about not only the need for affordable housing, but ways in which people are trying to address it. So that's tonight at 8 o'clock, WILL-TV, also on AM and online. In this hour of Focus, we're talking a little bit about European politics, economic issues, and we'll continue that conversation here in this part of the show with Kostas Kourtokakis. He's a professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. He is an expert on the EU and also Greek politics. He was good enough to spend some time with us last summer, at the end of the summer, to talk about what was going on in Greece at the time. And we asked him if he could come and spend a little time with us this morning, perhaps to react to some of the things that the ambassador had to say, and also to give us perhaps a little update on what's happening in Greece. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much.
Good morning.
We certainly appreciate it. Tell me about, I'm interested in your reaction to the level of optimism that the ambassador had about the possibility of in time, the economic challenges that countries in Europe are struggling with getting worked out.
Well, it seems like a lot of people right now in Europe are sharing the ambassador's optimism. Mm. Nobody is saying that the crisis is over. Everybody's sort of holding their breath, waiting to see what will happen next. But it's also my opinion that something has changed right now with this latest phase. It seems like things are a little bit under control, or at least they seem to be more under control than they were last summer, for example, or last November. It seems like this is everybody's breathing a long sigh of relief. But we all recognize, and I think the ambassador would probably agree with that, that this is just probably a temporary phase. And but you know, it's very important how this is going to be handled from now on is extremely important. So you cannot take anything for granted.
Well, perhaps you can just explain for take a moment to explain what happened in Greece, and then we can talk about the kind of assistance that the EU is providing for the country. But certainly when we talked last August, there was a great deal of concern about Greece and the possibility that the country could indeed collapse economically because of its sovereign debt burden. What really was the issue there in Greece?
Well, there were a lot of issues there, but it seems like what the European Union is trying to address is the issue of credibility. And in particular, the European Union is committing itself to giving financial assistance, in other words, a large sum of money, to the European Union. And a lot of the partners of Greece want to make sure that this money is invested well in Greece because they want Greece to do well. They want Greece to exit the crisis, and they want the Eurozone to exit the crisis. And there were a lot of concerns in certain European Union circles that perhaps there was a lot of instability, political instability inside the country. And so what happened is that there was a lot of pressure from the European Union on Greek politicians to unite and sort of provide on or present a unified front against the crisis. But I think, so that was the external pressure. And I think what has happened to some degree inside Greece as well is that a lot of politicians who have argued with each other for a long time, they decided that, it's time now to put some of our political differences aside and perhaps work together. And now I would like to say that this is a huge deal, not just in Greece, but, you know, that's just politics in general. You know, members of different political parties very often are very, very hard to agree. And so what has happened since the last time we talked, and that happened sometime in November of 2011, is that there was essentially a grand coalition government that included the two largest parties in the Greek parliament. And so they decided to join forces and support a so-called technocratic prime minister. So that's a prime minister, Lukas Papademos, who was the previous vice president of the European Central Bank. So he was a very high-profile economist with a big position in the European Union. And so he's leading the government. And some people, again, it depends on who you ask, but some people would say that he has restored credibility to some degree. It seems like, things are moving on. I mean, there is more consensus, and the terms of the agreement are being implemented. Some other people would not agree, but generally one could say that there is progress, definitely.
Yeah. Well, so what in exchange for this recently 130 billion euros, and I think that's on top of some previous money that was provided. So we're talking about a very significant amount of money that's been provided to prop up the Greek economy. What is it that Greece agreed to do in exchange for this money?
What is the most controversial part of this agreement is that there is a team of experts from the European Union who currently reside, and they're in Athens, in the capital of Greece. Mm-hmm. And so they monitor the situation. And a lot of people in Greece are arguing that this is a loss of sovereignty. And the EU version of this is that this is not a loss of sovereignty for Greece because these experts are there on the invitation of the Greek government to support the Greek program. And so it depends, you know, what side you're on and, you know, what you believe in. But there is definitely intervention in the Greek political system by the European Union. Of course, this creates controversy. But some other people would say that it's actually working.
Yeah. Well, what is it that the Greek people feel that they're what kind of concessions are there feel like they're being asked to make, or are they being asked to give something up or to give something back? Would there be some decrease in their standard of living as a result of all of this?
Well, I would like to start by saying this is not free money that Greece is getting from the European Union. There are loans that need to be paid back with interest. Mm-hmm. But of course, a lot of Greeks have had to give up on a significant part of their income. So we're talking about, you know, significant increases in their salaries, 30-40%. So the standard of living is generally declining. Again, it depends on who you ask. Some people say this was necessary, that the standard of living had been artificially inflated for the last 10 years or so. But there is no doubt that this adjustment is so rapid and so it's so fast that it's hurting people. Imagine if you had, you know, a salary, say, of $1,000, and that's what you count on. And then you take up a loan and then you may take up a loan for your house and a loan for your car. And you know that you'll be spending, say, $300 on these loans. I'm just making these sums up. And then suddenly you realize your income is going to decrease from $1,000 to $700. That's a radical decrease, and that sort of changes your whole calculation. And so a lot of people are finding hard to cope with the situation. There is homelessness has increased in Athens, in particular in the big urban centers. So more people sleeping on the streets. People who used to have pretty good lives, apparently, and even those people who have been able to keep their jobs, they have to cut down on their expenses significantly.
Yeah. I don't think that there is the expectation is that this if this does work, it's going to take some time, and I think that they have allowed a period of maybe 5, 7, 8 years before they really think that things are going to be settled down. So it's going to take some time. At the same time, I think also there seems to be some question about, in fact, whether this is going to work at all, and whether a collapse in the economy has been averted or whether it's only been postponed.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. Because, I mean, that's in many ways what politics is about. Politicians make decisions, informed decisions based on in the information and the evidence they have. There is an element of risk. In this case, I think they have done the best they could under the circumstances. I'm talking about the European Union partners. But what I would like to point out, however, is that this is not just a rescue of Greece. It's a rescue of the Eurozone, and that's why this has become such a big deal. And I think the ambassador put it very well when he said that Greece is, and Portugal and Ireland are just a small part of the larger picture. And if you take, like a big jigsaw puzzle, if you take a piece out, or a Jenga that I used to play when I was younger, when you take a piece out, you know, the whole thing falls apart. And so I think that's really what European Union policymakers are working for, to avoid not just the collapse of the Greek economy, which obviously is not desirable at all, but also the prevent the contagion effects and the potential collapse of the Eurozone, because that would be really detrimental for peace and prosperity in Europe.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Kostas Kordakakis. He's a lecturer and research assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois, and is an authority on the EU and also Greek politics. He was with us last summer in August when things were quite bad in Greece, and we talked a little bit about it then. And he's been good enough to come back and spend a little time with us to catch us up on where things are. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, so as you mentioned here, now the Irish, Ireland, Portugal have gotten bailouts. Now Greece has. There still are some questions about some other countries. I guess the thing that I read most about is Spain, the possibility of that there would have to be some kind of intervention there. Can the EU actually afford this? Or is it? Would the answer to the question be that the EU could not afford not to, as you say, help out Spain if it needed it, or somebody else if they needed it?
Well, the important point to make is first that a lot of the countries that are in trouble need to do the best they can to help themselves. And that's extremely important. I think that's happening, definitely in Italy. Spain, there have been some issues recently with the new prime minister, and he has been reprimanded by Brussels, by the commissioner for monetary relations. But overall, they're sticking to the program. Now, the EU is also doing its part. I was just reading the other day that they're increasing the firepower of this. They have established a common fund, sort of like an insurance fund, which will go up to the level of 700 billion euros. Now, some argue that this is probably not enough to bail out Spain, but the purpose, so some people are asking actually for €1 trillion. That would be much more of a better safeguard. But it's they're trying the best they can, and they're building all these safeguards.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this hour. The caller is in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I want to address two things. One, the issue of democracy, which the ambassador stressed, and there are many people in Europe who find this very problematic. That is to say, as you have repeated, the leaders of the European Union have decided this, the leaders have decided that, that it's not just a matter of surrendering sovereignty, but it's a matter of the decisions being made of the fundamental lives of people in all of these countries by a bureaucracy in charge of this operation. And I think that needs to be taken seriously and needs to be addressed. The second thing that I want to raise is also something the ambassador mentioned, which was labor flexibility. And it seems to me that what he's talking about basically is weakening the labor unions in Europe. We hear that word labor flexibility in the United States, too, with right to work laws being proposed. This, I think, is going to be a very serious issue for the European Union, as it is here. You have a higher rate of unionization in Europe than in the United States. But before our Reagan period, we had about 35% unionization. And by the time the advocates of labor flexibility was done, we're down to about 7% unionization. And my fear is that the same thing is going to happen in Europe as you make labor and the lower echelons of your society, economic echelons, pay the high price of austerity. I wonder if you could address that.
No? Go ahead.
The issue of democracy, of course, I absolutely agree with the caller. I mean, it's a major issue that the European Union has been trying to address for quite some time, not successfully. There are institutions in place that allow for the popular will to be expressed at the European Union level. One of the major problems, however, some people say that these institutions are not enough, of course, but one of the most important problems is that a lot of citizens are not involved in European Union-level politics. They're interested in their national politics. So, for example, when it's time to vote for elections for the European Parliament, which is the parliament of the European Union, attendance is and turnout is really, really low. We're talking about 30%, which is unheard of for European levels. So that's something, participation in European Union institutions and democratic processes is an important issue for the European Union. As far as labor unions are concerned, these concerns are raised in Europe as well. The traditional welfare model, the participation of interest groups in the decision-making process. But there are ways of including labor unions without necessarily eroding their power and making the government the government more efficient. And those ways have been utilized for a while in Scandinavian countries. So Denmark, for example, it has made its labor market more flexible recently without necessarily eroding the power of its labor unions. So there are ways, there are formulas that can reconcile the need for competitiveness and efficiency with labor union participation in setting wages and the conditions for the workforce.
Is that restricted to Denmark, though?
Yeah, it's a model that right now is used primarily in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries, but that could serve as a model in other parts of the European Union as well, perhaps with some adjustments. But what I'm trying to say, it's not a zero-sum game. You don't either get competitiveness or labor union strength. There are ways that the two can be reconciled. It just takes a little bit of imagination at this point because we don't have necessarily a lot of models we can use.
Well, I hope maybe in the future we can learn from Europe if that proves to be successful.
I hope so, too.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. We have just a couple of minutes left. I just as a way of sort of finishing up, I guess I'm interested in again, this idea of the whole project of trying to create this union, both political and economic, involving a large number of countries and countries who are some that are very big and some that are very small, and just to what extent that can work. Can everybody get an equal voice? And does that necessitate, though, perhaps the stronger countries bailing out the weaker ones when they need it? That's just something that's just going to have to happen.
Mm-hmm. I will agree with what the ambassador said on this issue, but I will also add something else. Mm-hmm. Which is that I don't think that there is, in Europe right now, in the middle of the crisis, any serious doubt that this is a worthwhile project, both in big countries and small countries. What a lot of people are arguing about is what kind of institutions should be put in place that can make the system work. So the ambassador mentioned here that there are big countries and small countries, states in the United States, and they all coexist peacefully. But also I would like to point out that in the United States, everybody talks about the checks and balances and how proud they are of the fact that, you know, the U.S. government has those checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there is something equivalent to that in the European Union. So they have to find politicians with the help of the citizens, they have to find a way in which both countries that are small and big, countries that are economically very strong and countries that are economically weak, find a way to coexist and sort of have their interests represented. They have made significant steps, I think, so far, but they need to adjust the institutions, because what the crisis demonstrates is that the institutions work very well in times of, you know, tranquility, but in times of crisis, something needs to be added to what exists already in the European Union.
Well, there, I think that we'll have to leave it. I'm sure we'll come back to some of these issues with other guests in other days. But for right now, we'll have to say thanks to our guest, Kostas Kodikakis. He's an assistant professor in political science here at the University of Illinois. He's an expert on the EU and on Greek politics. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.